And we are burning down the house. Here every Wednesday at 8 on heritageradionetwork.com. A continuing conversation about the culture of architecture and design, in which we tear down, lay forth, and build up the elements, the attitudes, opinions, obsessions, biases, fantasies, passions, and ideas that inform and direct the creation of our built environment. I am Curtis B. Wayne, your host. Our sponsor this evening is the Hearst Ranch. Now, those of you who are penniless artists in Brooklyn here, where we're located in the Garden of Roberta's, you need to save up your pennies, because Hearst Ranch is a purveyor of fine, grass-fed, grass-finished beef to some of the best restaurants. Also now to the Anaheim Convention Center. They are going to be providing all the beef to a very important location out there in California. Hearst Ranch has over 150,000 acres. Now it's 640 acres per square mile. That's a ranch that's 15 miles square. And they've been raising cattle in the old-fashioned cowboy sort of way since the 1860s. I know that's the Hearst's, the publishing company, and we thank you very much for being our sponsor. Here in Studio A at heritageradionetwork.com, our guest is returning from last week to continue our conversation about architecture and eloquence, Professor Roderick L. Knox. Hi, Rod.
How are you, CB?
You know, thanks for coming out again. It's another beautiful autumn evening here. We're looking out at the Garden of Roberta's restaurant at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick. And there's the fire pit going, and there are all kinds of happy hipsters in their knit caps and in their anoraks enjoying a November evening. Well, we talked about some really eloquent buildings last week, but, you know, we weren't done, so we've come back to talk about more. We ended up with talking about Gothic expression and the vesica piscis, which is a geometric form of two overlapping circles where the curve of each circle touches the center of its adjacent circle, and what you end up with is you called it a fish bladder.
Yeah, that's what it means.
Oh, okay.
Which comes from baptismal font.
Uh-huh. And it's used all over Gothic design, and also, apparently, are you a Mason? Are you allowed to say that?
No, I'm not a Mason.
Apparently, it's important in terms of Masonic emblems and things like that. And, of course, with Dan Brown's new book, where the Masons have an unholy campaign to suppress some sort of important arcane knowledge. I thought perhaps you might have been a grandmaster in your past life.
It could very well be the grail they've been looking for.
Oh, that was the Da Vinci Code. Was the
That Glastonbury is planned on the Vesica. And
In England?
Yeah, that where they have the rock and roll concert every year.
I don't know.
That's where the Holy Grail is supposed to be located.
Huh. Well, we'll have to do a little research and put that up on the companion blog. Before we started our conversation right here on air, we were talking a little bit about brutalism, which is an aesthetic movement in architecture of the middle 20th century, in which concrete is expressed in a way that is theoretically true to its form, because, you know, concrete is not a beautiful polished surface. If you see a concrete artifact, a floor, a wall, and it's nice and smooth, that took a lot of work. Concrete is, to some minds, ugly. Certainly very rough. The Romans had their own form of concrete. They called it a posolith. And the dome of the Pantheon, which is extremely eloquent, is cast Roman concrete. We would talk about brutalism. What buildings come to your mind?
Well, you know, in Cambridge, on the campus of Harvard, there is that Carpenter Center,
right, for the decorative arts or the study of this of art, yes,
of art and craft,
and that's by Le Corbusier, or Corbu, as we call him, and it spans an entire depth of a block. And describe, you know, if you were going to describe it to your students, how would you?
I would describe it as, a truly organic, voluptuous building. It's very delicate for
a concrete
building. And usually, concrete is all about muscle and raw strength. And this is very delicate and dainty in a way.
Well, let me try to describe it for people who have not been to Cambridge and seen it. There are two apparently disparate pavilions, side by side and slightly shifted in plan, and they're an expression of exposed concrete with glass walls that fill in the bays in between the piers. And then the ramp.
The ramp that goes right through the two shapes, which are really some sort of kidney-like shapes that are offset.
So there's some orthogonal components, and then there are the kidney sort of shape lobes that make space and are a contrast to the totally orthogonal buildings to the left, the Fogg Museum, which is a sort of a neoclassical mishmash. And to the right, I think it's the Harvard...
the campus.
Well, it's across the street
from
quad.
The corner.
Yeah, I think to the right, as you're facing it on Quincy Street, is the Harvard Faculty Club.
Faculty Club, which
is a little fudge cake of frou-frou with a gambrel roof, I believe, as I recall. And so it's in very stark contrast because it's all gray. It's a very somber presence. I mean, you know, the weather in Cambridge is not always clear and sunny. We have an almost North Sea kind of weather where the high clouds blow in off of the ocean. And it can be quite impressive if you're really into Flemish painting. And this ramp starts at Quincy Street, runs up and over and through, and that's a promenade that takes you into the heart of the building, both in plan and in section, that is, vertically. And then it heads over to the next street and has a hairpin turn and deposits you back on the sidewalk. So you could walk through this promenade on the ramp.
It's a shortcut through the block,
and but also it gives you views of the studios, and you can see what's going on where the students are working, and everything is all open. And it is a very eloquent building. I mean, there are, I can't think of, are there other Corbu buildings in America?
Well, you last week we talked about the Boston City Hall.
Yeah,
and it's a good thing to contrast this with, because actually the Boston City Hall, I believe they actually got their stuff from La Tourette, which done by the same guy.
A Dominican monastery in France, which is articulated. Oh, yeah, you're right. There's a lot of ripoffs there that Coleman and McKinnell did to La Tourette. But La Tourette has a rightness to it because it's nestled into its landscape, even though it stands in contrast because it's clearly man-made. And there's no attempt to naturalize it by using stone or anything. It's a concrete structure, and it sits in a, I think, in a valley, and all around it is farmland. And so it's a contemplative, fortress-like, very large pavilion, though, because it's sui generis. It sits on its own. It's one of a kind. It's an iconic building that is...
just has cells. It's relentless cells for those
Yes.
And it's a cloister, and it's just a...
But that's true. That's true to the building type of a monastery.
Yes.
If you ever have the good fortune to go to Portugal, you can visit the home monastery of the Knights of Christ, the very last vestige of the... Speaking of Dan Brown, the Templars. It's in Portugal, and it is a fortress because these were monks who were also armed. They
had to defend the...
Well, to a certain extent, they were mercenary monks, and they became very involved in the trade with the Americas on behalf of Prince Henry the Navigator, who himself was a Templar.
They're a very wealthy order.
Yes, which led to their suppression because there was certain envy, and they were an easy grab when... And that's where Friday the 13th came
from. It's easier to kill him than to pay him back.
That's right. They lent money to many different monarchs of Europe. And the Friday the 13th in October. And that's when they were all summoned and executed. Some fled. But that was the end of the Templars, except in Portugal. So if you visit this monastery fortress... You'll see that La Tourette actually has a lot to do with that monastic building type. Now, an architect who did, to my mind, very eloquent buildings across all building types, office buildings, airline terminals, is Eero Saarinen, who's not really a brutalist. He's, I think, a poetic romantic in a certain way. What would you say is your favorite Saarinen building?
I like the TWA building,
of course,
and I also
JFK. You can all find. I'm sure everyone knows that one. It looks like a bird in flight. It's wonderful.
Would you call that a brutalist building?
There are aspects of it that are brutalist because he's showing
the formwork.
The true form of the structure, and that is a thin shell structure. When we talked about that with the Gehry buildings, where they look like they should be a thin shell, that means like an eggshell. It's a form that supports itself, and they can be very, very thin. What was Candela's first name? I'm thinking it's Felix.
Felix
Candela was a structural engineer, and he was a real pioneer of thin shell structures. And you can have one of those structures, and the concrete is only 4 or 5 inches thick, which is very, very thin. If you are in a Manhattan high-rise apartment building, your floor might be 12 inches thick of concrete, and that's what's necessary in order to transfer the wind loads from the walls into the floor to make it stiff. So 4 or 5 inches of concrete is a thing of eloquence, and it's incredibly seductive from an architect's point of view in terms of economy of material. And Saarinen's TWA pavilion, terminal.
do you like his CBS building?
I do, and I'll tell you why. If you look at it from the street, standing in the middle of the street, you can only do that early in the morning because otherwise you get run over by taxis making a sprint across town because it's 53rd Street is a good street to get across. Not a lot of pickups and drop-offs. The black folds of the facade are like a drapery. And
most people know it as a black rock.
Yeah, black rock. It's a CBS headquarters, and they call it black rock. And it is, to a certain degree, like a stele. You know, if you think of Kubrick's 2001, when they discover the mysterious stele on the moon, it has that aspect to it. But the piers that encircle the building are triangular in plan. And so you have almost like a crimped curtain in and out. And the glazing is very dark also. And I like that. I would like to use that as the backdrop for, oh, I don't know, a choral performance. Set up a stage over the steps that lead down. Well, that's another interesting thing about the building. Usually buildings are set up on a plinth, and you go up steps to enter, almost like a temple. Whereas in the case of Black Rock, you go down some steps, and then you enter. And there are different, there's a restaurant in there, there are different things along in the storefront. Some people complain about that building because they intend to go into CBS and they end up going in someplace else because all of the entrances are equal. There's no hierarchy of this is the main entrance. And that's an interesting late modern effect where all entrances are equal. If the building was more modern, surely the main entrance would be greater, like in the Chrysler Building.
Well, I am not so easy. I don't forgive that too easily. I think he should articulate the grand entry, unless it's a secretive society or so. Like you say, it's a mysterious stele, and you have to know the code to get in. But why do you like it?
I like its severity.
But is it? It was the tallest concrete building in the world when it was built.
That's right. But it's clad with granite.
I think it's black
granite.
I think
we'll have to research
be,
that.
I think it might be the concrete that is somehow black. But whatever the cladding is, it might be a granite, but it isn't a concrete building. I mean, I think that
you're saying that because the cross section in plan of those piers around the outside are triangular. Why can't concrete
No, not at all. I'm saying that, as you well know, concrete, you know, requires a step back as it goes up.
Well,
yes, it does. I mean, that's what it wants to do. You got to do what the material wants to do.
I don't know why you can't just make a concrete pipe that goes up as far
but
as you want.
It gets thinner and thinner as you go up. Now, in these times where concrete is really steel, you can do that. But back then, the base is bigger than the top.
I mean, it should be. You think it should be.
Well, Mies acknowledged that when he did his... is Lakeshore Drive
tower.
Tower.
The tower sits on a plinth, and the plinth is very large, and then the tower is thin and needle-like.
But it's concrete buildings, they had a step back to it. And I appreciated that.
We go back to modern, though, I think that's possibly just a fain, romantic... reaction that goes all the way back to New York City zoning codes that required setbacks.
No, I'm saying that even though if he's going up, I think it would have been nice if those columns somehow had stopped a third of the way up, a little setback, or maybe two-thirds of the way up, and then set back a little... Yeah, I sort of wedding caked up.
Well, I think what you're describing now is Chicago, the tower, the Chicago Tribune Tower, which I think, although it's ornamented with Gothic effects, goes up and it steps back and then it steps back again.
But that's a steel building. You know,
where do we draw the distinction, and why should a concrete building, because it's
a reinforced concrete building, is sure. You know very well that
end up with a very long vertical cantilever, as regards earthquake resistance and wind, but I respectfully have to disagree with you that that concrete wants to step back.
It does. I mean, it's a nature as you go up. it becomes the floor at the very bottom of a concrete building is the footings are thick.
Right. The supports have to be necessarily greater because the compressive load is greater.
And as you go up, it wants to thin out.
Well, that would have been nice if each of those triangular piers actually thinned a little bit.
Yes, he could have done that.
He could have.
Yes.
I mean, after all, he did design the...
it's a beautiful...
arch in St. Louis is also...
I like the building as a thing. That he made this form, and you can do it out of concrete. Yes, fine. But I'm just... we are speaking about the truth I think you're obligated to actually listen to the material and never find yourself making it do something it doesn't want to do.
Fair enough.
That you're supposed to work with that material and say, what is it you want to do? And exploit that. Mm-hmm. And all good, not that he wasn't a good architect, but sometimes they get carried away with the purity of their idea, and when you give them a blank check, they take it to the limit, and sometimes that doesn't bring a beautiful reward. It may bring a dramatic,
but it may not be eloquent.
I'll say it's eloquent. I could have been more eloquent.
Let's take a little musical break and see how we feel. This is Burning Down the House, and that was a little Beethoven, just to, you know, get us all juiced up again. Very eloquent music. Burning Down the House this evening is brought to you by the Hearst Ranch, 153,000 acres, full of happy, grass-fed, grass-finished cattle. Finest, finest beef you're going to find anywhere in the United States. And they're good friends of the station, and we thank you for sponsoring us. So that rousing music actually got me thinking about brutalism again, because there's something, you know, con brio, con fuoco in Beethoven, with vigor, with fire. I think the worst examples of brutalism. No offense to the dead there, but Paul Rudolph. Paul Rudolph littered the landscape with really sick-looking brutalist buildings all over Boston. He was very popular in the 1960s. Don't just laugh. Just speak.
I think that Corbusier started all this stuff, but his stuff is unsurpassed. The stuff he did in India, Chandigarh, and all of the stuff he did in Ahmedabad. You can't get the mill owner's building.
That's Pakistan now. At the time, it was still India, though. It was pre-partition.
No, it still is India.
Chandigarh?
Yeah. It's just it's close to the border.
Okay. I haven't been there. Have you been there?
No, but...
Did you go there?
I
don't mean to be hectoring you. I'm just asking.
No. I plan on seeing it very soon.
That would be great. Yeah, well, these are concrete buildings in a semi-desert sort of area. And concrete likes the desert, I think, you know?
Yeah, because it's a heat sink, and it's a temperature modulator, and you can use it that way in tropical climates.
Or in desert climates, hot climates.
Or even where hurricane, it's good for hurricanes.
Too. Well, yeah, because it's very stiff and
heavy. It's hard to blow it away.
Yeah, hurricanes take limber buildings and laugh at them and rip them to shreds and scatter their components all over the landscape. Whereas something that's stiff just hunkers down and the winds just blow and it laughs back at them. Good brutalist buildings. I've talked on this program before about the Jaoul houses. Do you know them?
Yeah.
Have you visited them?
Yeah, the one in right outside of Paris.
In Neuilly, yeah.
And there's another. He did that house contemporary with the Ahmedabad stuff, and he did one a lot of them in Ahmedabad. That was some. They were contemporaneous.
Yeah. I will put up some of my slides that I took when I was privileged to meet Madame Jaoul, the widow of the man who commissioned these. It's two houses and one lot in Paris. And what's interesting about them is that Corbu used a Catalan or South Mediterranean sort of aesthetic with flat arches supported by parallel brutalist concrete walls that are clad with a very nice brick on the outside. Why he didn't expose the concrete, I don't know. Maybe Jaoul wanted brick. But so they're very nautical. They look like odd sort of boats because each floor slab is it's flat where you walk, but underneath it's a very shallow arch covered with tiles. But then here and there, for artistic effect, the formwork is exposed, and so there'll be concrete as you're walking up the stair. And you'll see where the boards were and the concrete oozed between the edges of the boards. And as we were walking up, Madame Jaoul, who was this frail, white-haired lady, very gracious, however, patted the wall and said, "C'est brutal!" And with a great smile. She liked it. She liked her concrete wall. She patted it every time she went by. And so perhaps brutalism is an acquired taste, but certainly it was an eloquent pair of houses. The proportions.
You know, he designed his own tombstone in brutalist concrete.
Yes. With the universal man and the sun shining out of his navel, and You all need to look at the Modelor man, the Universal man. Always kind of post-Cubist sort of cartoon, but with the hand upraised towards the stars. I'll put an image of that up. It was all about an expression of the aspirations of the new age of technology and architecture improving the quality of life. One of the most famous aphorisms of Corbeau was that a house should be a machine for living in. And if you look at his bathrooms, for example, there'll be a bathtub, but then next to it will be a place that's curved in a way that's semi-ergonomic for you to recline on and recover from your hot bath, almost like a Turkish bath, where you have the hot and then you have the cold. And I think that's, you know, extremely, almost decadent these days, where many of us don't even have bathtubs, you know? But let's get back to Saarinen. You know, what makes Saarinen a really good architect, to me, is the expression of materials. Now, your comments about BlackRock are duly noted. If those triangular piers had slightly slenderized, shall we say, as they went up, and which is perfectly possible, because if you look at the St. Louis Arch,
right,
that arch
does that
thins right. as it goes towards the top, because
it's 2/3 of concrete structure, by the way.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. It's one would think it's a hollow, but the base, it's really a steel-clad concrete arch.
Well,
except for the top, the very top.
Oh, it's at the very top.
It's they actually, it became just a hollow, just about
practically hollow steel, very thin. Steel,
yeah.
Is it steel or is it concrete?
It's stainless steel
on the outside.
On the outside, but at the top, I think it just became stainless steel.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So thin that was enough. Oh, that's really...
The concrete went up about 2/3 of the way.
That's kind of hot. I'll have to look into that.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, they built that when I was just a wee boy in shorts. And
it's a very scary building to be... I call it a building because you can go in it, and it is a viewing platform.
There's a little subway car that goes up inside.
And an inclined thing. It's like being in a womb. You're in a fetal position, and you get up there, and the thing sways in the wind. And you're
I can think of other buildings that I've been in that swayed, like the World Trade Center was really scary.
Yeah. Or the one that Trump now owns, the GW building, they had to send them home.
Oh, the Gulf Western building.
Gulf Western building.
Western building that's now Trump International.
Elevator cables would slush around on a windy day. They had to send people home.
That's exciting. Philip Johnson did that renovation. Did you know that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, and he put an evening dress on it, a glamé dress.
A glamé dress. Yeah. You're the expert in glamé, which is a mylar gold fabric that Professor Knox used to spectacular effect in a pavilion along the Hudson River, about 15 years ago or so. Unfortunately, it was a temporary structure, and it's all gone now. Can we see pictures of that on your blog, rodknox.com?
I think I have. Yeah, I think I have a picture.
You should refresh that.
I have it. Yeah,
that would be great. Yeah. Well, so last week we talked about the Garnier Opera. Do you think that there's any eloquence at Lincoln Center with the trio of buildings around the piazza, and then the Vivian Beaumont, also by Saarinen, over in the corner?
You know, I believe I have to. Eloquence is things that are well thought out. They may be I may have a problem with the concept, or with it doesn't. Few buildings are.
Truly eloquent.
Truly eloquent. And when I think that the most eloquent buildings are really the ones that at the turn of the century, when they were dressing up steel, and they really had to make them eloquent. And you could see that
There was a taste for opulence, for sure.
Yes, but you also know that these guys actually studied this stuff. And these guys actually seemed to know how to put a building together. I listened to one of your broadcasts, and you were talking about this lost art of a building, that architects don't do that anymore. It's construction.
You know, don't get me started. You know, I ran into one of my former colleagues from Perkins Eastman today, who's like-minded in a way that I have an obsession about how do we really put buildings together and make them hold up. And he was tasked with discovering why a recently completed building from that firm leaked. And I said, and he gave me no details. I said, I'm sure it's because there's no jam flashings or sill flashings.
That's a crime.
Yeah. And he said, yeah, how did you know? I said, well, when buildings leak, that's always the problem. They left.
If you can't keep the water out, you failed.
Yeah, and that is, I mean, that's a whole other conversation that we could have. But I think that a part of the problem that we face in our profession is the means in which we do or we do not do, mostly we fail to pass on the knowledge of older architects to the younger ones. And my friend said, these kids just don't want to hear anything from a white-haired guy like you or me. Well, not that I'm white-haired yet, but I will get there.
Architecture is a white-haired profession.
Yeah, it is an old man because it takes so many decades to
really
learn.
It takes a lifetime. You never stop learning it.
That is correct. And I think that one of the problems of the paradigm shift from drawing by hand to using computers is, one, you can't really critically, analytically, or evaluatively, which is not really a word, but I was in an adjective sort of mode there, see what is going on by looking at the drawing on a screen. You have to print it out and look at the hard copy. And in the older days, when drawings took a long time to do by hand, people would drop by and they'd look at what you were doing and they could just give you a quick correction, you know, which then became a whole, in the 1980s, as a management tool, the one-minute manager of giving a very brief crit, as we say in architecture school, or criticism, and then leaving it alone. Well, constantly in this studio, we would get that in the drafting room. That doesn't happen anymore. Each person is plugged into his or her own little personal computer. And often, not that I have anything against Apple Inc., but they're plugged into their iPods. And so there's not the chatter going back and forth, and there's not the communication, and there's not the collegial exchange of information. And so the modern architectural studio manager takes a meeting to ask people, well, how are you doing? Instead of taking a daily round of hard copy and looking at what people have drawn.
The word rigor is tossed around, rigor this and rigor that, and I don't really see it. I see less and less rigor. They've given over. You walk through architecture schools and you see the computer has gotten very good at graphics, and it's very easy. And
oh yeah, it's incredibly easy to create all sorts of fantastical forms, and then we figure out how to build them. But that doesn't mean that they are eloquent forms. And there is something I want to talk about, and that is the 19th century term Gesamtkunstwerk, which means a total art work, which is what architecture should be. Let's have a brief bit of music to accompany Gesamtkunstwerk. Thank you. This is Burning Down the House, and that was from Richard Wagner, Die Meistersinger. You know, you listen to that in your own the privacy of your own home when you're feeling in the mood for really robust and eloquent music. I'm a big fan of Wagner. Now, first I have to say that we're brought to you by the Hearst Ranch. Thank you very much. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host, and I'm here with Rod Knox, professor of architecture at Cooper Union. Gesamtkunstwerk is a term that comes up always when you talk about Wagner, because the costumes, the music, the sets, it's all an integrated experience. It's very architectural. In a very essential kind of way, because it creates an environment. During the break, we were talking about the Goetheneum, which is a shrine to theosophy designed by Rudolf Steiner, who was an architect. He was not part of, but friendly with, the Viennese secession in the 1890s. These were architects and artists who declared that they had seceded from society as the way that Key West occasionally over the years secedes from the United States and declares itself the Conch Republic, or Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard decide to secede from Massachusetts. So they didn't really secede, but they were saying that the for them the status quo wasn't happening, and so they set out to promote their own aesthetic ideals. And so it's a building, I believe it's concrete, the Goetheanum, yes? Yeah. Have you been there?
Yeah.
Well, what were your impressions of it? How about the scale and the proportion?
I mean, you know, it's a sort of an occultist shrine that I really don't know.
To me, it looks like a marzipan cake that's been decorated. You know, that if you're making a marzipan cake, it has to be sort of rounded because the almond paste needs to have an eggy shape to it. Otherwise, it cracks. And, you know, marzipan is sort of like concrete. You know, it wants to have a form that is self-supporting.
You know,
does that throw you for a loop?
No. I think you pretty much describe what it is. But you compare that to, say, the Einstein Tower. Or, you know, when you... I wanted to say that I think that Adolf Laus is also...
It's not Adolf Laus. It's Laus.
Please.
People are going to think that the guy had bugs.
No. Okay. All right. Okay.
L-O-O-S, Jack.
Yeah. Yeah, no, but it's... you know, you can call him...
An early 20th Luce. Century architect.
What do you call him? Luce?
Los.
Laus?
Los.
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 Two
well,
O's. It's Los.
I'm not, you know, I'm not really... what is it?
I speak German.
Yes, you're...
It's okay. You're an American. Yeah. Well, actually, you're a Jamaican-American, but that's all right.
Yeah, it's
you're
good
a Navy,
enough. It's
you're
close
a Navy
enough
veteran,
for me.
And it's, I salute you on Veterans Day.
On Veterans Day. But in
Let
any
me shake
event,
your hand.
I think that... you may look at his buildings on the exterior, and it may not look that elegant, but on the inside, they're very elegant. And
eloquent? Do they really speak to the soul? Do they engage you, as Goethe said, as frozen music?
Well, I suppose these guys were... truly master builders, because they had so much latitude in their client's life that they controlled even if the maid is going to live in the house or not, or whether what suit the master should wear, or how he should fold his clothes, or if he came there and the shades weren't in the correct position, he would just have a fit. And I would have to say that's a certain kind of overpowering eloquence, that when you can sort of seize that kind of power. And
but there also with it comes a responsibility.
A responsibility.
To have seriously considered the circumstances of life and have created a total environment like the Wagner opera that leads to... an inspired mode of living. And back to Rudolf Steiner, he was also an educator. He also was a pioneer of biodynamic farming, which is something that other people on the Heritage Radio Network have talked about, an approach to having plants and animals living in equilibrium in the landscape. When you were describing,
he had some buildings in Berlin. In Berlin, can you recall?
I don't. But what I wanted to say was, when you were describing the architect with latitude to reorder the way of living, and that also goes back to Corbeau.
Frank Lloyd Wright.
I was going to say that impinging on is really what Frank Lloyd Wright attempted to do in his prairie school houses, and then throughout his career, by dictating his point of view and making it real in the built environment for the people who lived in his houses. He didn't like clutter, so there weren't closets. He didn't think that people needed endless changes of costume, so the coat closets were very minimal. We have only a few minutes left in our conversation. Let's have musical cut three and then talk about what we've learned about eloquence. To burning down the house. We want to talk a little bit about truly eloquent buildings, and of course that means that we go back to the Baroque era. Mm-hmm. Baroque, Rococo, the late Renaissance, Borromini. These are not buildings that are easily emulated, but certainly there are things in them that we can learn from. You were talking about San Carlo alla Quattro Fontana, which is at a corner of four streets, and there are four fountains. And how would you describe San Carlo?
I would say the site is just an impossible site, and what he did with that site is just remarkable. It's just... The building was just, it grew out of that site. There is no wasted space. It's very elegant, and yet still it's very generous.
Well, so for those of our listeners who don't know what San Carlo is, it's a church. Actually, it's a chapel. And if he had had unlimited space, it wouldn't be nearly as impressive, because it's... I'm trying to describe this.
It's tight.
It's very tight. Yeah. But if it was a very large church that was topologically folded in upon itself, then you have San Carlo alla Quattro Fontana. It is multi-lobed in its space, many, many niches, but the niches have niches, and it's all packed into a tight little corner space, and yet at the same time, the scale... which is the relative relationship of elements, and the proportion, which is 3 to 5, you know, as you look at it, how high is it, this whatever you're looking at, this elevation, to its width? And that's another thing we can talk about. When your students come back next week and we start talking about their takes on eloquence, scale is different from proportion. But go on.
But you walk down the street and you see the Bernini, another chapel about the same proportion by Bernini, is contemporary.
Yeah.
And that has a different kind of eloquence.
Actually, Bernini is more playful, because Bernini will do things like take a baluster in a railing that... is like a squared off amphora, you know, and he'll set those in a row, but he'll alternate them. So one's upright and the other's upside down, which is a really fun kind of little joke. It says that basically it's just a fun form and I'm just playing with it. It's up, down, up, down, up, down. Richardson did that with the Glessner house, where every baluster, every like fifth baluster, it was a progression. All these spindles had different shapes, and it adds liveliness and it adds visual delight to the people who use the building. Gives them something to think about, which is an eloquent gesture to leave for the generations.
You have an obligation to give it your all. And you have an obligation to work hard for your client and to bring out back to delight, you know?
Yeah.
It's
our very first program.
And when, I mean, it is a scientific method. When things work out, you know they're right because it's beautiful.
Right. And it gets us right back to Bucky Fuller, who says that if my solution to this problem is not beautiful, then I've got it wrong.
Wrong, yes.
And so,
how many times have you come to a conclusion that you didn't really anticipate, and you were dragged there kicking and screaming?
Absolutely. Oh, you know, it's not a building that I brag on, but it's the building that my clients wanted. It's the Bridgehampton National Bank. You know, they presented me with this book, and there was this little pavilion that had been the Mount Kisco, New York Town Hall. And it was a book by Bob Stern. It was the architecture of Mott B. Schmidt. And I said, this is what we want. Okay. And I said, well, your program is five times larger. I can't just put this in the copy machine and do it. But they insisted on certain elements. Now, these were not decorative elements that I would have chosen. Certainly not a cupola or a hip roof. Actually, a mansard roof. I wouldn't have chosen stone coins. I wouldn't have chosen that they had a portico with Ionic capitals. But I did architecture anyway.
You did it right. That's what they wanted.
I inserted a progression of scales of proportion as you enter, and I got them kicking and screaming to agree to an atrium. And one of the board members insisted that there should be a stair, and so the stair takes you up inside this atrium. And I absolutely insisted that if there was a cupola, it was going to let light into the building. And so they have a domed space above this atrium, and it's all done up in Georgian Queen Anne style, which, you know, but
it's delightful.
It is very delightful. It's the building they wanted, and they're very happy with it.
And that's success.
It is a success. It wasn't what I expected. But it's what they actually, it was more than they ever expected. It actually attained in certain parts of it a sense of true architecture, and it's what they wanted, but more. It's what they wanted on steroids. They do not understand why they enjoy it, but they do enjoy it.
They asked for it and they got it.
And I'm happy to have been able to, you know, produce that for them. And the way that we did it is we worked collaboratively. It was not me as the great artist or architect imposing my point of view, which is very interesting. I mean, we need to talk about this at length some other time. Because the design process was collaborative and we had design meetings with a whole herd of people, everyone understood the trade-offs, and I think that is the future of true, eloquent architecture, to get as many voices involved so we understand the compromises that necessarily must happen in architecture. And if properly managed, it can be beautiful.
it usually is.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I mean, of course, there's always there's a healthy tension that you must have.
And that always exists between architect and owner.
Yeah.
We've run out of time.
Well.
Dang.
No, it's, you know, before we end, I must congratulate you. I enjoy listening to your programs, and I think
thank you
that it's hard.
I enjoy having you on.
It's hard to listen to people talk about architecture. I'm bored when I go to lectures. I enjoy listening to because I think a culture that doesn't understand architecture or does not appreciate it is really doomed to just, you know, erode.
And that's what we're trying to do here on Burning Down the House at heritageradionetwork.com. Thank you, Rod.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And we're going to go out on a beautiful, beautiful solo sung by Doug Perry, tenor. Philip Glass's conclusion to his opera, Satyagraha. Thank you for listening. We were brought to you by Hearst Ranch. Let it play. Bring it up. Thank you.